everybody. My name is Kay, and I am an addict. And it's good to be alive in God's grace today. For that, I am truly grateful for these rooms of Cocaine Anonymous. I don't know why I thought about it. I said if I, and when, and this isn't no if, but when I die, on my dying bed, I want to go out with a big old woo! One hell of a ride. I'd rather go out like that, enjoying myself, absolutely insisting on enjoying life, than sitting on my dying bed, laying on my dying bed, saying I shoulda, woulda, coulda. I saw a gentleman out in the hall today, and he said, a little while ago, and he said, man, you look nervous at the service. And I said, well, the truth of the matter is, I am nervous. And if it ever comes to a point to where I stand in front of my people to speak the truth of recovery, to speak the truth of what God has done for me, if I ever come to a point to where I am not nervous, it's time for me to not do it anymore. There was this drunk walking down the street. And he was stumbling down the street and stumbled up into this Catholic church, and he ended up in the confession booth. And he sat there in the confession booth. And on the other side, the priest had cleared his throat. He never said anything. He just sat there. And the priest cleared his throat again. And the drunk was just sitting over there, and he didn't say one word. So the priest just got a little annoyed, so he knocked on the wall. And the drunk said, I don't know what you're knocking on that wall for. Ain't no toilet paper over here neither. Let that sink in. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. Homer G. Phillips Hospital, city number one. I think it's an old folks' home now. When I was born there, I don't remember anything about St. Louis. Even though I was born there, I don't remember. All I remember is Charleston, Mississippi. My grandfather and my grandmother I called Mama and Daddy. I did not know my biological mother, nor did I know my biological father. My grandparents were my mother and my dad. I remember, I just have to qualify myself for this program because I remember down in Mississippi at 5 and 6 years old, I had a cousin, my first cousin named Ricky, and Ricky would go outside occasionally, climb up on a big old tractor, unscrew the gas cap, and he would hoof the gasoline, and he would fall off the tractor. And I went like, wow. And I'd see him go out there and do it again. And one day, while I thought, well, nobody looking, I decided to go out there and unscrew the cap, and I hoofed, just like he did. And I fell off the tractor. I was like, but for that moment, I was hurt when I fell off. But for that moment, it was a sense of relief. And I'm saying that to say that I was already a product for this program at a very young age. My grandparents decided that they would move to, well, I guess I was about 8 years old, and they decided to move to Memphis. And they moved to Memphis, and it was a big culture shock for me, moving from the rural area into the city. And when I moved up there, I was highly influenced. I was highly influenced by a lot of people doing a lot of different things. I was a hustler, and I've always been a hustler. I've been a hustler all my life. I took up to collecting soda bottles and raking people's grass and cutting grass and raking leaves. And that was my little hustle to make a little money, make change as a youngster, 8, 9 years old. Mind you, all of that time, straight-A student, I've always had the ability to just look at something you tell me once and I got it. It's just what God gave to me. I have the ability to process information a little bit different than the average, whatever that is, the average person. So they, a lot of teachers and a lot of instructors, they were kind of, so this guy's pretty special. He's a little different, you know. And so I started hanging out. And this one guy in the neighborhood named Milton, he would go and hustle with me. And one day Milton actually, we cut the people's yard and we went back later after we had cut it. And he raised up the window of the house. And since I was the smallest, he said, "You go inside that house and you open the door." And we robbed the house, 9 years old. And I said, "Wait a minute, what is this about?" So we started doing it because we were making money selling the goods. And it was more money than raking. It was more money than it wasn't as hard as mowing the yards. And I was like, okay, this is good, this is good. And I mean, and Milton was a professional shoplifter. He was older than me. Milton was about 13, I'm about 9, and Milton was a professional shoplifter at 13 years old. He would go in the store and walk out of there and look like he didn't have anything. And he'd have a mother load. When he unpacked that stuff, he said, "You got all that stuff? Where'd you get it from? Where'd you put it?" And he started showing me how to do that, right? Well, it was a trial run for me. I never had done it before, and I actually took it upon myself to go into this department store, and I distinctly remember what I stole. I stole a holster with a gun in it, a police badge, and a police hat. And as I was walking out the store, the store manager came and grabbed me by my arm, and he called my grandparents, and they said, this kid's down here shoplifting, come and get him. And my grandparents were getting older, and they was like, this kid is kind of out of control. So he called my mother up in St. Louis, and she said, my grandparents told him, they said, "Look, this guy's getting a little bit too much for us. Here he comes." And I went to St. Louis about 10 years old, and I was over in the area of Natural Bridge and Kings Highway. I went to a school called Lexington Elementary School. I lived on Palm, 5119 Palm, right off of Ashland. And over there, I started excelling in school, and I met brothers that I didn't know. And I had, and I'm having this complex about how come you kept them and you didn't keep me. And I'm in my head, but I didn't voice that. I didn't ask mom that. I just felt that. And it was a heck of a feeling that I had to walk around with. Feeling like I wasn't good enough. I wasn't good enough. I was undeserving of her love. And one day we were walking home from school, and my brother Ron, he said, there's a guy named Howard. And he saw Howard coming, and my brother Ron, he took off running. And I said, "Man, what are you running from?" He said, "Boy, you better run. Howard's going to beat you up, and he's going to take your money." I said, "Man, I don't care about no Howard. I ain't going to do nothing to me." Howard beat me up, and he took my money. So when I saw Howard again, I had a plan. I didn't run. I knew something about a bully because I was a baby of the family and I got bullied around a lot and I was small, I was frail, probably weighed 105 pounds soaking wet. And Howard came and I took my belt off and I took the buckle and Howard would never mess with me again. Even to this day, his name is Howard Bailey. And he ended up moving out into the suburbs. My mother, we lived in the city, and right around the 70s, early 70s, we moved out into University City. And I have to tell you a little about University City. University City, that's the name of the township. It's University City, right outside of St. Louis proper. St. Louis County it is. And the reason it's named University City, because it sits in the shadow of Washington University. All of that land that University City sits on is owned by Washington University. Washington University leases that land back to the city every 100 years for $1. But they had a covenant with the city, University City, and they said, well, 80% of the streets will have to be named after a college or university. And our students participating in education are allowed to come into the school systems as part of the curriculum. So by virtue of what we got early on was a higher level of education just by being in that environment than most people would in college. Being the kid that I was, I never got picked to be on basketball teams. I never got picked to be on football teams because I was too skinny. I had this rail head and just the skinny skins and bones. I wasn't buff like this. Well, skin and bones. And nobody would ever pick me. And the only reason I would get picked is because I'd be the one to make the team even. Well, come on, Kenny. So all this inferiority and not good enough and can't measure up and it was just inside of me. And I ran into these friends out there. They were twins. They were named Trent and Tyler. And Trent walked up to me and we were playing and went in the backyard. And Trent said, you smoke weed? I ain't never smoked weed in my life. Guess what I said? Yeah. I smoke weed. And he had some pink papers. They were strawberry papers. Easy wires. And I was like, this is cute. This is pretty. And we smoked, and I smoked that weed, and nothing happened. And I'm like, man, why am I making my throat all scratchy and going through all this for nothing? And the next time we did it, I got the effect. And immediately, I felt free. I felt the freedom that I never felt before. It was something inside of me that has always been just churning and yearning, and it's just been there. And nothing could fill that void. I was hurt. I was. It's all of the hurt and pain. It was just there. And that was the beginning of my end. I went through 6th grade, 7th grade. By the time I made it to 8th grade, I was in junior high, and my favorite two classes in the 8th grade were first and second lunch period. I didn't even know how I made it that far. I made it up to the 10th grade. All I did was went there and sold my goods. We sold nickel bags. Sold nickel bags, first, second, lunch period, and I was out of there. Gone. Truancy, everything. Hanging in the neighborhood, growing up, flashy guys, flashy cars, guy named Pancho. Man, if I could see Pancho. Man, if I could see Pancho. The fact of the matter is I did end up seeing Pancho. Pancho told me, he said, Kenny, Pancho was flashy. He had the nice car, the girls would all come around, and, oh, Pancho. And I was like, oh, yeah. I would be like, Pancho. And he said, well, Kenny, look, man, if you think it, you may as well do it. And I grasped onto that, and I ran with it. And every thought that came to my head from that point on, I did it. It didn't matter. Without regard to how or what or who I hurt, it didn't matter. I was on a mission. I don't know what the mission was. The mission was not clearly defined, but I was on it. And I'm just running through life. The big book calls it roaring through people's lives like a tornado. Well, I can add a couple more adjectives to that. Tsunami. What category hurricane would that be? God. Out of all the, when I moved to University City, I ran into this group of people that was called the hippies. And the hippies had a way of life. It was all about peace and love. Now, I was thinking, maybe this would be what I'm looking for, a little peace in my life and a little love. And they showed me love. You ever heard the phrase, high as a hippie? Ooh-wee! I had the keys to their mama house. They would let me in. I could come and go. I could crash there. Parents let them smoke in the house, let them do whatever they wanted to do in the house. And I was like, this is really, my mom wouldn't stand for this. She walked in the house, what's that smell? Everybody got to get out. And so we hung out over there, and I started experimenting with stuff called psychedelics. Oh, yeah? Mushrooms. We're going, they would say stuff like, Kenny, we're going on a trip tonight. And I'm like, cool, where are we going? And when are we coming back? I mean, man, blot of acid, purple haze, God, orange stuff, the powders, it was crazy. And I freaked out one day, man. I was walking through the park, just buzzing, and I saw a friend named Nick. And Nick saw me walking through the park, and Nick had on a furry vest. And Nick said, he saw me walking and he said, Kenny, come here. And I'm looking at him like, hell no. And I started backing up and he was kept coming, come here, man. And I turned around and I started running. I thought I saw a bear. I was running. If I hadn't fallen and skipped my knees up, I'd still be running to this day. I mean, heart pounding. And I said, God, if you just let me get off of this one, I'm through. I'll never do that stuff again. And I never done it again. I was through with the psychedelics. I've never gotten to a point to where I got high, and in the middle of the high, they said, oh, no, it's just getting started. It's just getting started. And I sit up here and I say that because in amazement. I'm saying it in amazement because I'm so amazed that I have the ability to sit up here and string along sentences to make paragraphs and make it sound halfway decent. I mean, I had to have fried my brain. And that's a testament of my higher power. That's a testament of God. Having me sit up here, stand up here in front of you guys and put a sentence together. A coherent one, I might add. I dropped out of high school in the 10th grade. Had enough. Terrorizing the neighborhood. Running around with gangs and just, God, we didn't buy nothing. You ever see these signs on stores saying only three students allowed in the store at a time? We started that. Because 20 of us would walk in the store and one person would buy just a piece of gum. And we got everything else. The other 19 got everything. I mean, beer and whiskey. It didn't matter, man. So in the neighborhood, my mom got afraid because a detective knew, the police knew what I was doing in the neighborhood. And they came to my mom and they said, we know what your son's doing. We can never really catch him because the technology wasn't what it is today. They said, but we're going to get him, even if we have to frame him. And that scared the heck out of my mom. So at 14 years old, my mom decided to put me in juvenile detention center. And I was already hurt, and I went to juvenile detention center. I went to halfway houses. I was even committed to a foster home for the next 3 years of my life. In those 3 years of my life, I was disconnected from my family once again. It was three words I never heard in my grandparents' house, and I never heard these words in my mom's house. I never heard, "I love you." I never heard those words. While I was in these care homes and being an incorrigible and belligerent juvenile, I was still doing the same things I was doing, but it was progressing. On the north side of St. Louis, running around in gangs called the New Yorkers, which was known as the Vice Lords, and it was all this stuff, man. And a guy came up to me that I kind of looked up to, and he said, "Kenny, you're turning 17 now. And all the things that you've been doing, you can't do them anymore. In the state of Missouri, at 17, you're classified as an adult." He said, "You will not be going to the little bitty house anymore. You will be going to the big house. So you need to start recruiting younger people." Sounds like a plan to me. Started recruiting younger people. And I decided, I saw a commercial that was on TV about the Marines. And I saw a commercial. And I went down and I registered myself. And they said, "Well, we can't really sign you in because you're not 18. You're going to have to get your mother to sign." And my mother had no clue. And I knew I was going in the military. And it's 5:30 one morning and I heard the horn blow outside. Never them coming to pick me up. But I had never presented my mom with the papers to sign. So I went and woke her up and I said, "Mom, I said I need you to sign these papers." And she's waking up, "What you talking about, son? What paper, boy?" I said, "These papers, I'm getting ready to go in the military." And the horn downstairs blowing, bum, bum. I said, "They're downstairs waiting on me." She said, "You going where?" I said, "I'm going in the Marine Corps." She says, "Is that what you want to do?" I said, "It's either that or stay out here on these streets." And she said, "Where the pen is?" Here you go. And she signed me in. Man, what a hell of an experience. Less than 18 hours, I was standing on a set of footprints, being called a lady by a man that's 4'8". I got a fro, got my big hat tilted to the side, and he said, "Get off the bus, lady." I was like, "Dude, I'm not the one, you know. Hey, you don't call me a lady and get away with it, you know. No fighting words." That man said, "Everybody else stay on the bus. You, get off." That man put me in a push-up position one, and my arm's still hurting today. He said, "This is push-up position one. This is push-up position two." I stayed in one, man. My whole body started trembling. He said, "If you let go, I'm going to force everybody to get down and put you in position one." Man, I don't know how I made it through that night, man. And they zipped all my hair off and they gave me some clothes that was all green. And I'm like, what have I gotten into? Juvenile wasn't this bad. But what happened was I went on and made it through boot camp and went to training out in Camp Pendleton, California. And they had some stuff out there called California Love. And it was actually some marijuana laced with angel dust. And man, I hit that stuff and I felt like I had arrived once again. I was like, this is it. And it didn't last as long as the other trip. But I was like, man, this has never been here. So anyway, I ended up moving over on, and they sent me 2 years, and I had a duty station over in Hawaii. And let me tell you about Hawaii. I have to tell you about Hawaii. Paradise. If you've never been to Hawaii, go. Go sober. You will get to enjoy it. I went to Hawaii And everything escalated. Everything in my life. Some of the best marijuana I've ever smoked in my life. Some of the best cocaine I've ever in my life. And I could not show up for drill at 7 o'clock in the morning. I would leave on a Friday and they would never see me no more. 8, 10 days later, they docking my pay. I didn't care. They were saying, you have to stay on base. You can't leave base. You can't change out of putting civilian clothes. You can't go anywhere. I didn't care. And that went on for 2 years. And in 2 years, they came to me and they said, hey, Kenny, we like to make you an offer you can't refuse. And I said, well, I'm all ears. If I can't refuse it, let's hear it. They said, well, we'll give you an honorable discharge if you leave the military within the next 24 hours. We'll give you a one-way ticket home. I said, okay, what's the other part? Or we'll give you 6-6 and a kick with a BCD. What that is 6 months in the brig, 6 months, no pay. They'll kick you out with a bad conduct discharge. I said, let me weigh this one up. Where's the ticket? And I took the ticket and I went home. And when I went home, everything changed. You got to remember this. When I went in, I was 125 pounds soaking wet. When I came back, I was 150 pounds all steel, 10 feet tall. And I saw the bullies that used to mess with me over by the swimming pool in Heman Park. And they were like, oh, yeah, this, oh, yeah. I said, man, be quiet. You're talking too loud. Don't nobody want to hear that. They was like, who are you? I'd show them who I was. And I was like, man, I can't do this. I felt like crap. Still running 3 miles a day, doing everything, but I'm still getting high. I tell you, man. My life was in the crapper. My life had been in the crapper so long, guys, gals. I thank God that whoever was in charge of the flusher did not push the flusher. Because it was there. I had no doubt. I seen death as an option other than living the life that I was continuing to live. Move back to St. Louis. Move back to Memphis. Because everything was getting crazy up there. What really happened was, I came from East St. Louis, hanging out in East St. Louis one night, partying all night long, got home at 4:30 in the morning, and my mom had put me out, but I wasn't living in the house. I was living in her garage. And as they let me out, a car pulled up. She lived on the corner. A car pulled up in the middle of the street and stopped, and a guy started walking to me in a full trench coat with a big hat on. In February. And he was walking toward me. Nobody in sight but me and him. And I'm like, what is this? I didn't know what it was. So I came and I stood in the middle of the yard and put my hands in my jacket just like this. And I stood. And he backed off. I knew what that was. I knew what that was. That was a hit. A hit that didn't happen. So I decided to go down to Memphis because I wanted to do a geographical cure, because I figured if I go down to Memphis and I could start my life all over again and things would be different. And I went down to Memphis and I started working for this Hotel Peabody, and I became a chef down there. I went through, they sent me to school and they made me sign all these agreements that I would work for them for a period of time, and I worked under some of the best chefs in the country. And man, good times. I worked there for 3 years. January 1 of 86, I was the executive banquet chef. And January 1, I was responsible for all the food that came into the hotel. I didn't care what it was. If it was a food item, I was responsible for it. I was ordering food, trading it to the bartenders for fips. I'd give them a hamburger, they'd give me a shot. That's how it worked. They promised me a huge raise after 24 months, and I had met my agreement with them, and I didn't get that raise. And I had a resentment for the next year. And I held that resentment to them. And I said, on January 1, every room was booked. Every hotel room was booked. The lobby was booked. Every function room was booked. And I made sure, I premeditated, I made sure that they didn't have enough food to cover those events. And at 6 o'clock, when all the services start, I went to the bathroom. And I never came back. While working for them, I got to meet a lot of people, a lot of influential people in the business. Talk to people that own produce companies, or people that own liquor companies, people that own seafood companies, and all these people that own restaurants and chains of restaurants. And we would go out and have these meetings once a month, and after the meetings, I knew where to get the party drugs. And they said, well, Kenny, they would give me their credit cards and stuff, and then 2 weeks later they'd show up and say, Kenny, can I talk to you for a minute? And I was like, yeah. Hey, you still got that credit card I gave you a couple of weeks ago? And I'm going, which one? And I'm just swiping the cards and doing what I do, and they never said anything. I'm talking millionaires. I was just Kenny. And they had no idea. I never had to afford myself the ability to make amends to the Bells group, because I felt if I did, they would press charges against me. And our literature says that we should make those amends except when it would cause harm to myself or others, and that would have caused harm to me, because I don't have looking through bars mentality. Can you put some on my book? I just don't have that mentality. Things got really crazy in the 80s, really crazy. That's when the crack epidemic hit, and my hustling was slow, and I started to decide that I wanted to sell a little bit, and I wanted to become the great pusher and the great dealer, and it all worked. I was doing well. I was selling the powder, but when they introduced the baking soda, I had a friend named T, and I walked over to T house, and I said, T, well, let me back up. I was at the grocery store, and I had my apartment, I had my car. I was doing pretty good. And I went to the grocery store, and I met my girlfriend on aisle 5. And I said to myself, that's my wife. And I gave her my beeper number. And I said, you know, call me. And she called me about 2 hours later, and I told her where I lived, and she came by, and I said, this is my right wife for real. So we sat around and we smoked and we drank Hennessy, and we was just chilling, man. And she said, 2 hours later, she said, Kenny, do you get high? And I'm like, what you think we've been doing for the last 2 hours? She said, no, do you get high? And y'all know what I said. Yeah, I get high. I figured that would get me to second base at least. I get high. Well, this chick did something I never seen before in my life. I told you I'm a pretty avid guy. I know what stuff is. I know what Pyrex, and I know what hemostats, and I know what all this stuff is. And she broke all this stuff out like it was a chemistry set. And I'm going in my mind, what is going on? What is? And she said, do you have a razor blade? What do you want a razor blade for? This is stupid. And she hit that thing, man, and her eyes rolled back in her head. And I said, OMG, I want some of that. I don't care what it is. I've got to have it. And she passed it to me, and I'm shaking and don't know what to do. And she grabbed it back and said, you don't get high. And I said, well, show me. Show me how to go. And she showed me. And about 30 minutes later, she said, we're out. Do you have any money? I'm a little hustler. You know, I got a few dollars stashed away. And I went back in the back and I peeled off a couple of $100. And I said, is this enough? She said, yeah, I'll be back. And I sat there and I waited. And I waited. And I went, oh, no, man, no. There goes my wife. We were so good together. Wow, we were going to have kids and we were going to do all this stuff and you pulled this trick on me. I never saw her again. And I went over to T House. And T would give me, T was a baller. T was a serious baller. He on the low-key baller side, baby. T was my boy because I DJ. I'm a DJ and I DJed in clubs. I DJed in all the high-end clubs. It was a high-end club. I probably had a two-hour set there. That's pretty much what I did. I was good at it. I would keep people on the floor. I would keep you on the floor for 45 minutes, give you a break for 10, and put you on the floor for another 45. Everybody rushed to the bar. It was like a cycle. It was like, and that's what I did. And when I came on, it's the Kenny O show. You know, that's what I did, you know. And T was a DJ also, and he wasn't on the level I was on, so I was teaching him a lot. But he was a hustler. He was a serious baller. And he would give me whatever I wanted. And I went over there to get a little package because I'm getting ready to experiment with you know, what I just figured out. And as I was walking out the door, T said, I'll see you later, Kenny. And as I was getting ready to close the door, I said, man, you ever smoke this stuff? He said, close the door. He said, no, not you, Kenny. Not you, man. I'm going like, what do you mean? He said, well, you need to stop selling that powder stuff anyway, because ain't no money in it. And if you're going to do it, I may as well show you how to do it. And he showed me how to work the microwave that night. And I told you I'd grab on the stuff real quick. He didn't have to show me but once. I didn't have a microwave, but by the time I made it home, I did. And I got a microwave and I went home and I messed up so much stuff, but I figured it out. I figured out the right proportion to ratio, you know, and I made it work. I did not leave that apartment for 4 days. Did not leave. Couldn't leave. Wanted to leave. Lost my job. Lost everything. And that brings me back to my cousin, because when I was living with my grandparents, I would see my cousin fly up to Chicago, come back, and these three guys would park in front of his house, and they would stay there for 4 or 5 days. And I'm going to work and coming back, and I'm like, these cars haven't moved. And I go over and knock on the door, and they'd be sitting in there watching CNN, just staring at me. And I'm like, man, what are you guys doing, man? I said, you guys want some water or something? What's going on in here? Y'all having these little old hanky-panky homosexual stuff going on? Talk to me. And I said, nah, man, we good. But I know what they were doing now. I didn't know what they were doing then. They were stuck. And they could not move. Everything spiraled down. I saw my life. My life was deep in the crapper, and I just wished somebody to flush it. Life was crazy. Life was just out of control. I lost everything. I was living on the streets of Memphis. I lost my car. I was walking everywhere I had to go. I had everything I owned could fit in a little knapsack and on my back. Everything. And in the pit of my stomach, I had the same feeling that I've always had, like a void, a hole that needed to be filled. And something was wrong. I didn't know what it was. And a friend of mine came by, and we drank, and we drank, and we drank, and I drank myself. I just drank. I started drinking. I went in on a drinking bender. I remember when I came here, I was telling people, I said, I never had blackouts. And they were like, you never had a blackout? I said, nope. And after I stayed around here for a while, I realized that there were not just little small periods of time. There were big gaps of time, like months, years of my life that I could not remember. My blackout periods didn't look like yours, so I couldn't identify with my blackout periods looking like yours. So no, I didn't have them. You would drink and go and wonder how you got home. There's parts of my life I'm still remembering to this day. I'm like, God, really? And then, like, they said, I drank myself into a stupor. I smoked myself crazy. I was creating neurosis every time I put that in my body. I was going into shock. I had a heart attack. And I was watching, I don't know if you guys remember this episode. It's called 24 Hours on Crack Street. And it was an NBC special. And when people would hyperventilate from smoking too much, they would breathe through a bag. They would take a paper bag, and they go, and they would breathe in it so that they would get oxygen. So I kept a bag in my pocket. And we'd be on the north side of St. Louis, and they said, hey man, they got some stuff on the south side that's killing people. And we were trying to get over to the south side. They just don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to do this. And it was killing people. It was giving them heart attacks. I had a son, and this is what I call a miraculous intervention. I had a son. My son was born, and all of a sudden things changed. Nothing, I mean absolutely nothing, ever stood in the way of my getting high, my using, my abusing, nothing. And this little boy was born. And when that little boy was born, everything changed in my life because suddenly I became responsible down inside of myself. I didn't want that child to grow up not knowing his father like I did. But I couldn't do anything about it. And I went to work one day, and his mother said, I said, well, take me to work. It's time to go to work. She said, baby, I don't have enough gas in the car to take you all the way out there and come back. You get paid today. So you just cash your check, bring some Pampers and milk back, and it'll be all good. And I got paid. They didn't see me until Monday morning, dead broke. And my baby boy, they had made some makeshift Pampers out of pillowcases. And that just shot through me. And I called an old friend of mine, and I said, man, drive me down to the VA hospital. I went down to the VA hospital, and I went to the triage. I went to the emergency room. And I said, I need to check in. And they said, what's the problem? I said, I got a drug problem. They said, well, you need to go over to window number one. And everybody was lined up over on window number one. And then window number one, there's this lady behind there. She was interrogating people. What are you here for? And I said, well, I got a drug problem. And she was, I'm saying it low. She's saying it loud. You got a drug problem. I'm like, yeah, I got a drug problem. She said, well, what's your drug of choice? It's loud. And I'm like, cocaine. And she's like, cocaine? I'm like, can you tone it down a little bit here? You know, I'm not really trying to work. I'm trying to. And I eventually went back and talked to the nurse. And the nurse came up and she gave me a index card. It was a pink index card. And it said, you come back on this date and you only bring these items on this card. And I said, ma'am, I don't think you understand. And she said, no, I don't think you understand. You come back on this day and only bring those items that's on this card. And I said, well, I don't know if I can make it 3 weeks. I said, I don't need help in 3 weeks. I need help today. And she said, well, that's our policy. I said, ma'am, if I leave this building tonight, I don't know what I'm going to do. I said, I might hurt somebody. I might hurt myself. I might even hurt you. She said, stay right here. I'll be back. I said, oh, Lord, I did it again. She's going to get the police. And she came back, and she said, follow me. And she took me up on a ward called 2D. And this is the mental ward. This is where people are walking around on Haldol and Thorazine. And they're walking around looking. They're measuring walls with these tape measures and protractors, but you don't see them. And I'm sitting up here going like, what the? But you know the crazy part about that is I felt comfortable. A couple more days I went on down to the AD unit because they had a bed available, and This was March 11, 1989, and I was going to meetings, and I was doing all the things, and I was like, okay, this is cool, this is cool. I ain't got the problem he got. I don't have the problem she got. I didn't do that. Nope, he's too fat. Nope, I didn't do that. That's for fat people. Nope. I left that treatment facility in 28 days, and for the next year and a half, it was hell. All the things I heard people say that they did in these rooms, I damn near did them all. I was, the disease is progressive. Over any considerable period, it gets worse, never better. And I get that. I went back on October the 18th, 1989, and I said, hey, I forgot something. I missed something. They said, what you missed? I said, I don't know. I didn't get it. And I went back. And I went to this convention they had. It was a Bluff City convention. And that's why I'm really big on conventions. Because I got sober. And I'm in the treatment. And I go to a convention. And I go to this big convention. And everybody's walking around happy. And I said, oh, this is why they're happy. They're drinking all this coffee, right? They high on coffee. They found a new drug. It's caffeine and coffee, right? That's what they're doing. And the caffeine has the same effect as cocaine. I just saw my mind working. And they were asking me questions like, do you know Bill? Do you have a big book? And I'm going, y'all know what I said, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I got back to the treatment facility. I got back to Ward 2A, and Nurse McGill said, Kenny, how did you enjoy the convention? And I said, Nurse McGill, I said, I got two questions. And she said, what's that? I said, who is Bill and what the hell is a big book? And she said, oh, Bill Wilson is one of the founders of the program, da, 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 da. Oh, and here's a big book. And I went back to my bed, and I started reading that book. And I started finding answers to stuff. The answers were in the book. I mean, that night, I was reading the doctor's opinion, and it says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effects produced by alcohol. Over any considerable period, they get worse, never better. It says the persistence of disillusion is so astonishing that many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. I'm sitting up here going like, whoa, that's why I drank. That's why I drugged, because I wanted to change the way I felt. And that begs another question. If I wanted to change the way I felt, what was wrong with the way that I was feeling in the first place? How do I get there? Well, the steps took me down through there, and I discovered all of that too. And I'm going like, wow, this is crazy. And so I start finding answers and the solution, and I'm starting to go into meetings. I got out of treatment. I went to a rooming house. I stayed in the rooming house. I didn't have a car, so I walked 13 miles some days home because the last bus runs at 10:30, and I got off at 11. And I was some nice walk, and I was staying in a place called Salvation Army. And it was downtown Memphis, and I would meet women, and they would say, where do you live? And I said, I live downtown. I live downtown, baby. And she said, you want to ride home? And I would have her drop me off in the front of William Lynn's apartments, which is loft apartments, which is three blocks from the Salvation Army. And as soon as the tail lights out of view, I hop it on over to the Salvation Army, still ashamed of who and what I am. I got sober in AA, and I went to this AA meeting, and it was nothing in this meeting because my sponsor, 3 months in, my sponsors did not want me to go to NA, and I didn't know anything about CA, so I was in AA, and my sponsor sent me over to this meeting called the Central Group, and in this Central Group, it was old white men. I mean, it was like the old white men group. And they had handlebar mustaches with wax on the end. And they had these Sherlock Holmes S-shaped pipes. And they would look over the top of their bifocal glasses and call me boy. Now, where I come from, boy fighting words. And they said, boy, we ain't afraid of you, boy. We don't care about what you did. We don't care about no gangbanging. All we want to know is if you want to get sober. Now, if you want to get sober, you sit your tail down there and learn how to live, because we're going to teach you. And I'm like, I wanted to leave, but I didn't. October 18, 1989. October 17, 1989. This is exactly what happened. It was a thoroughfare to the expressway. All the 18-wheeler trucks come down through there. My life was so bad, I decided that I would go up. I made a decision at 9 o'clock that night. I was going to the bridge, and I was going to jump in front of the next 18-wheeler that came down through there. They call it the jumping off point in the big book. Says he wishes for the end. He can see himself not living this way, and he can't see himself living the other way. I can't see myself with it or without it. He says this is a place of loneliness that only a few would know. I think some of you know that place. And he wishes for the end. And I promise you guys, this is a thoroughfare to the expressway to 40. Interstate 40, all the 18-wheelers. And I stood on that bridge, and then I said, the next 18-wheeler come down through here, I'm jumping. Now, a VW Bug would have took me out. Right? But I got to have an 18-wheeler. Not in 20 minutes, not one 18-wheeler came down through here. And I walked off that bridge cussing God. In this meeting, Central Group, I stayed sober the first year on a resentment. Because this old man named Frog says, boy, I'd be surprised if you stayed sober for a year. And man, they would go around the room and sharing, and by the time they get to me, I'm ready to share some of this good, powerful message I got. And by the time they get to me, they make announcements. And they would go around the room, and I'd say, okay, they start on that end, so I'm going to go in and I'm going to sit in the first chair, and this time they'll start over there. I'm like, man, y'all playing games with me. And Frog told me, he said, man, I'd be surprised you stayed sober here. You're so full of it. And I got sober for a year, and they gave me my coin, and at the end of the meeting, I ran up to Frog, and I was like, man, you remember when you told me that you would be surprised if I stayed sober a year? Do you remember that? And he said, no. I was like, I mean, I went through all of this to prove to you, to prove you wrong. He said, well, hell, it worked, didn't it? I was like, well, yeah, it worked. But by this time, a friend of mine came over and he said, Kenny, man, you need to go to this Saturday night meeting. And it's over here at this other side. And I went over to the Saturday night meeting. And it was a Cocaine Anonymous meeting. And I walked up in the meeting and they weren't talking. They were talking my language up in there. They were talking about running out of money. And they were talking about peeping out of windows. And they were talking about crawling on floors. And I was like, yeah, that's me. That's what I was doing. You see, I met this girl named Cherie, and every time I went to do my thing and I get high with Cherie, Cherie said she thought I was crazy. She said, you are a fool. And I'm not saying you're a fool. I'm living in abandoned houses, and you're trying to kick me out of a house that you don't even own. You got to go. Man, this is not your house, man. You can't kick me out. And every time I got high with Cherie, I used to get high by myself, but when I get high with Cherie, because she was kind of cool, and she thought I was sexy, and I thought she was sexy too, so we kind of kicked it off. But she called me a fool, because every time I go and get my dope, I cut it in half, and I crunch it up, and I throw it in the air, and I let it hit the floor. She said, you're the biggest fool I ever saw. 2 hours later, we down there on the floor. She said, you so smart. Boy, you smart, boy. You're intelligent. But that was the insanity. Because the worst thing for me to do was get down there and not find nothing. God. When I got sober in the 88, I had 9 W-2 forms. I worked long enough, just long enough, to get a paycheck. And I was off to the races, and I had to go and find another job. Mm-hmm. Well, I went to this group, and I saw her going to CA, and my sponsor didn't want me going to CA, and I was still going to AA, and I got involved in service work. I was emptying ashtrays. I was washing windows. I was chairing meetings. I was doing all the things that they suggested that I do. And I became just a service work person. I was GSRs and groups, and I got involved. And then you newcomers, get involved. Get involved. There's always something for you to do around here. And I would be remiss if I didn't send the shouts out to the convention committee for inviting me out. I thank you guys. Thank you for having me out. 10 years down the road into this deal, y'all. Everything, I'm doing everything that I supposed to do. And 10 years into this deal, I want to blow my brains out. Nothing's wrong. But nothing's right neither. It says a man that fails to enlarge his spiritual growth is a man that's not thinking. So the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Since it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action, we're headed for trouble if we do. Alcohol is a subtle foe. And over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. I have a progressive illness. When I'm in this program and I'm doing all the things that you suggested, if I'm not enlarging my spiritual growth, then I am regressing. I'm going backwards. I'm treading water. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. If all you want to do is stop drinking and stop using, take step, honestly, 1, 2, and 3. Don't do nothing else. And you don't have to drink no more in your life, but you'll be one of the most miserable. I'm dressing the part and I'm showing up. Boy, you sure look sharp. Boy, that's some nice gaiters you got on, boy. Boy, that's a nice chain, nice ring. I'm dressing up the outside. But I'm like a can of sauerkraut on the inside, all shredded up. The literature says it's a long period of reconstruction ahead. I don't know about you, but when I got here and y'all circled up at the end of the meeting and y'all prayed, I would make sure that I was close to the door because I didn't want to have anything to do with God. I had neatly evaded the situation altogether. You guys would talk about how you had been lifted up and all of that, but the minute you started talking about God, I cringed and I dropped my head and I was like, You see, my grandparents made me go to church every Sunday, every Tuesday, every Thursday. I was in church. And I was afraid of that God because that God was going to get me. That God was going to cast me into a lake of fire and brimstone and I would burn forever if I sinned. Well, I sinned. I was going to hell with gasoline drawers on and I didn't want to have nothing to do with that God. That was my granddaddy God. I came here, y'all said, hey man, get a God of your understanding. Not your granddaddy God. And y'all said, hey man, grow your own. I could relate to that. And I got a God today that loves me in spite of all of my imperfections. God, my higher power loved the most imperfect part of me. I struggle with my imperfections to this day. Oh, yeah, we're human and we don't supposed to be perfect. You may not struggle with your imperfections, but the big book called my imperfections are what the big book called character defects. Those are the things that stand in the way of my usefulness to him and you. My ego, my pride. The seven deadlies. Those are the things. And how do I remove those things out of the way and become more useful? Well, y'all gave me some simple suggestions when I got here. You said, trust God, clean house, help others. I wasn't doing that at 10 years. I was going around being a show out. And I wanted to kill myself. And I went to my sponsor and I said, man, this ain't working. He said, what ain't working? I said, man, I just want to die. And he said, well, look, man, we're going to get you some help. And I went to a therapist. And let me tell you, there's nothing wrong with a therapist. Because my sponsor is not a therapist. But he knew what to do. He knew that it was out of his control, out of his power, beyond his grasp. He said, I'm going to get you somewhere where you need to go. And I went to a therapist. And the therapist opened up another part of me that I didn't even know. You see, I hated my mama. I had a mama wound. To this day, I didn't know my daddy. You see, all of that stuff that I had back then, my life was like driving down the highway, my life highway, in a big old station wagon, just driving down the highway. And one day I step on brakes and all that stuff that I've been throwing in the back come up front. And I'm looking at, what the hell? At 10 years, I hit brakes and all that stuff that I never dealt with came right up front in the front seat with me. And I'm like, whoa, it was too much for me. Y'all said, Kenny, uncover, discover, and recover. I hadn't uncovered. I went back through those steps. I cried like a baby. I reached down and I did the fourth step. I told people stuff that I thought I would never tell anybody. And I just felt so much relief from that. I felt like the weight of the world had been lifted off my shoulders. My mom started calling me baby. I called my mother by her first name until I got sober. I was 11 years sober. It was the first time in my life I ever called my mama, mama. The guy that she didn't want to see, I had all her codes, I had everything. I had her bank accounts, I had everything. And I'm in Memphis and she lives in St. Louis. And I always said that if my mama died, I don't know what I'm going to do. The 3rd of September, 2010, my mama passed. And man, you people in these rooms, y'all held me up. Kim was there. Kim S. Chicago, Illinois. She was there. And man, you guys propped me up. And I said, I'm out of here. This was my first year of being a trustee, my first conference. And I said, I'm out. I don't want no more. I don't want to be trustee. I don't want to be nothing. I just want to go to the airport and get the hell up out of here. And they said, where are you going, Ken? I said, I'm going to the airport. Well, you just can't go to the airport. Yes, I can. I'm going. They said, no, man, you got to get a ticket. I get one when I get there. I got a pocket full of money. They said, no, it don't work like that, man. They said, we're going to show you what to do. I said, and they called there. They told and they made reservations and they said, well, you leaving in the morning? And I went home and I thank you guys for giving my mom a son back for 13 years. And I was able to bury my mama. Not only did I bury my mama, I eulogized her. Because the preacher didn't know my mama. He didn't know my mama. And I was sitting up and I was saying, I can't do this. I can't do this. And a voice spoke to my spirit. God spoke to my spirit and said, who would be better to do that than you? It's 4 cars parked in my driveway right now, and 3 of them are German. And I'm not saying that to be bragging or boasting. This program has given me not just material things. This program has given me not just good looks. This program has given me something that the richest people in the world cannot buy. And it's peace. It's serenity. It's hope. It's faith. It's courage. The best part of waking up is CA in my cup. And CA is hope, faith, and courage. With those three, I could take on anything, anybody, anywhere, at any time. And you don't believe me? Try me. But I know for the newcomers, get busy. Don't just sit around here and watch everybody else. Don't just go through the motions. Find you a higher power. Get you a sponsor. Find you a home group. Find you a good big book study group. And get busy. And no matter what happens, do not pick up the first one. Use the phone numbers to call somebody and say, hey, I feel like using today. I could not tell you that, oh, I never wanted to use again when I got sober. Yes, I did. I used to wake up every morning and ask myself, Kenny, do you want to get high today? And some of those days was hell yes. And those are the days that I called. And I said, man, this is going to be a rough day. I feel like I'm going to use today. And they said, where you at? And before you knew it, they were over at the house. And they take me and they make me go and hang out with them for the rest of the day. And they said, you okay? I'm okay now. And what they did was allow me a reprieve of just enough time to put it off. And that was the key for me early on. I just need to put it off for a little while. I knew how to stop, but I didn't know how to stay stopped. You see, if I put it off today, then tomorrow come and I put it off, I just built a little bit more awareness and I etched it in my brain a little bit more how not to do it. So the more I do it, the further I get away from it, the more I practice it, my thinking about it starts to change. The obsession is not as strong and it's not as intense. It was this guy named Wade. Somebody saw Wade. Wade would share in a meeting. Wade would share all of his hot stuff in a meeting. And he would say, man, I have not found it necessary to take a drink or drug in the last 10 years. And for that, I'm truly grateful. Somebody would come behind Wade and say, Wade, we saw you drunk last week. He said, yeah, but it wasn't necessary. So when I hear people say that it wasn't necessary, I'm like, okay, question mark. It just wasn't necessary. I've never seen anybody like you, like me, that would cling on to something that's so damaging, we will hold on to it for dear life. It seems like we're addicted to pain, and we just want to cling on to it. And it will drag us down, and we will hold on to it. I'm here to say let go. Detach. Do not get mentally attached to something that you cannot physically remove yourself from. Took me a long time to learn it, and I'm just sharing it with you. I keep an open mind to everything, but I attach it to very few things. I'm very selective with what I attach myself to today. I choose to be around. In another book, it says, "You know by the company you keep." I don't hang around people that drink and drug no more. First time I got out of treatment, I went back to the crack house with a big book and a Bible. I did. And I'm sitting up in there and I'm telling these people, you don't have to do this no more. I found the answer. Look right here on page 58. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I said, I got the answer. They said, man, you blowing out high. Will you just go? I said, no, I'm not going anywhere. I promise you, I'll be over here on the couch in case you guys got any questions. They said, this guy is crazy. Then I eventually went back and I left the big book and I left the Bible. And they said, you want to hear it? And I was like, yeah, I want to hear it. And then they mocked me. What about the big book now? What about the Bible? I don't hang around them people no more. I know what they're doing. They're doing the same thing now that they were doing 30 years ago. And I'd like to thank you guys for celebrating my birthday with me because I celebrated 30 years last Friday. And from where I come from, you celebrate your birthday all month long. And it ain't no one day. It's a whole month. You know how we do it. You say, this is my birthday month. So stop holding on to the things that cause you damage, that cause you pain. I'm like, how long will we continue to cause pain? How long? It doesn't have to hurt as long. If I get pain today, it's an indication to me that something is wrong. I need to check it. I need to look at it. And I don't care if it's physical pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain. I need to stop. I need to hit the pause button because something is wrong. I know, it's just a suggestion. But we listen to suggestions, but we obey pain. So let go. Stop holding on to the things that cause you pain. I'm going to say this and I'm going to sit down. Before I do, once again, I'd like to thank everybody. I'd like to thank God for allowing me to see another day of recovery. Because we're leaving here. I had a friend 20 years sober. He went home and he shot his wife and blew her brains out. And I'm going like, why? Why? What was he thinking? And I understood what he was thinking. He was holding on. He was holding on to death. We insist on living today, right? Free yourself. The big book says we've been granted a perfect release. But I'm here to tell you, just because you're released don't mean you're free. The way you find freedom, the way I found freedom, is to free myself. Is to free myself from anything that will cause me harm or anything that will cause me danger. Detach from it. I don't care who it is. It could be my mother. If she's causing me that kind of... I got to let her be her. I got to do me. Again, billionaires, if they could pay to get what we get in these rooms, they would be more than happy to give up their riches just to get some peace of mind, just to get some freedom. So stop holding on to the things that cause you pain. As children bring their broken toys to us for us to mend, I brought my broken dreams to God because he was my friend. And instead of leaving him at peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways of my own. And at last, I snatched him back and cried, "How could you be so slow?" He replied, "What could I do, my child? You never did let go." That's all I got.
Thank you. That was so awesome, man. Give him a hand again. Kenny W. And as a congratulations on behalf of the Midwest Regional Convention Committee and the great area of Nebraska, we have a plaque for you. Make sure I have the right one. Always open the wrong. Did I open the wrong? I did. Every time. Not marked.
You know the address and get the kind of face there.
It says, I'll let you read it. Go ahead and read it.
The 31st Midwest Regional Convention, Omaha, Nebraska. The best part of waking up is CA in my cup. Kenny W., thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope, October 25th through 27th, 2019.
I'd like to thank my promoter. I'd like to thank my mother.
Yeah, I'm going to put it in here for you. My man.
I'll take care of that, bro. You go. Absolutely.
Okay. Could I have Tyrone come up and read? Reaching up. They didn't tell me nothing about that. Okay. Go ahead, Tyrone. You want to do the 50-50?
No, I don't. I respect you.
Okay.
We have to read them all.
Okay,